Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views and the views of our guests. Now, we are going to have with us tonight, from the Institute on the Constitution, this Memorial Day, good friend, Pastor David Whitney. Before we get to David, I want to just read you a poem from Memorial Day. It was written by one of our good friends, Annette Adams, who has put together a book of her poems. If you want to know more about that, you could give us a call. But this is her Memorial Day poem. I was there when all those boys my age went off to fight a war. And I was there when those same men returned to us no more. I've entertained those heroes on the barren beds of pain, those glory-gutted veterans who to this day remain. Have you ever been in a holding pen where we keep those dregs of war? Behind sad eyes you hear their cries. Was this worth fighting for? I've seen those haunting graveyards causing tears to blur my sight. Those endless rows of crosses making fields of silent white. Their voices plead, remember me. I heard my country's call. I too was free to hide or flee. Instead, I gave my all. But while we are remembering those who died to make men free, and thinking of those crosses, signs of death for liberty, let's not forget the one who, when he heard our father's call, who too was free to hide or flee, but chose to give his all. He faced a world at war with sin. No friends marched by his side. No flags waved in his honor. All alone for us, he died. But that grave should not keep him, nor forever still his breath. He won the war to end all wars, demolish demon death. So remember those white crosses and those sacrifices grim. But remember, too, the cross of Christ. There's hope because of him. All hail the power of Jesus' name. We still can sing his praise because his cross cures death's dark loss and brings eternal days. Well, with that as a thought, let's get to our special guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney. And, of course, David has his own church. He certainly is a minister of our Lord, but he also was concerned about what's happening to America. And so he works with the Institute of the Constitution back there in Annapolis, Maryland. David, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dan, it's an honor to be with you, especially on this Memorial Day, as we remember those who, as the poem said, gave their all that we might have the God-given liberties preserved in our land. And as you know, the Institute on the Constitution is designed to educate people across America about the truth of what our founding fathers believed and the country that they formed, what the Constitution was intended by our founding fathers, their original intent. And the lecture that we're going to look at tonight deals with the philosophical worldview of the founding fathers, what they believed about government and what formed their essential foundation in terms of building that. We need to understand, first of all, who the major influences on their thinking were. Lutz and Heinemann have done a research. They've looked at 15,000 writings of our founders from that founding era, both letters that they'd written and speeches that they'd written, and they studied these extensively to discover who were our founding fathers quoting. And they discovered that, and these, you know, Lutz and Heinemann were not Christians, not writing from a Christian perspective. They were just doing this as a research project. It was published in the American Political Science Review, 1984. They discovered that 34%, far above any other quotation source, 34% of the quotations of our framers came from the Bible. In other words, the Bible was the chief source of the framers' thinking when they put together our constitutional republic. And then if you go down the list of the other sources of quotations, you'll find the next in line is Baron Charles Montesquieu, a Christian who wrote The Spirit of the Laws in 1748, and his main contribution to our framers' thought was that first, that God is the author of all law. That is, if there is a legitimate law, it comes from God. He is the author of all law, and that because of man's sinful nature, man has a move and depart from the law of God, to violate the law of God or reject the law of God. And then they also understood from Montesquieu that civil government is necessary to keep men within the confines of God's law. Dr. Stan, that's a very radical thought for most people today, that the whole purpose of civil government, which our founding fathers accepted, which they believed and they wrote about, the purpose was to keep mankind, who tends to go astray, to keep mankind within the confines of God's law. And Montesquieu also contributed the idea that the sinfulness of human nature causes government to tend to become despotic. And we have certainly seen that in our own history here in the United States. And Montesquieu also contributed to their understanding that to keep government moderate, that is, to prevent it from becoming a despotic tyranny, it's best to separate government power into three branches: a legislative branch, an executive branch, and a judicial branch. And actually, Montesquieu's idea there comes directly out of Scripture that speaks about the Lord is our king, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our judge. Speaks about those three branches of government. And Montesquieu also made it very clear in his writings that Christianity makes government more humane. If you were to compare the governments of the world, you will discover that every government is based, civil government is based upon some religious principles, some religious ideas. Whether it's Hinduism, or Buddhism, or Muslim theology, or Christianity, there are some religious ideas underpinning that, and Christianity is the only one of those that really makes government more humane. Then in addition, the next down on the list, the Bible was the first most quoted, Baron Montesquieu the second. Then next on the list was Sir William Blackstone.
Could I just interrupt there, David, sure, for a moment? I think that the one thing that people should remember about Montesquieu is he wrote about the republic form of government. In other words, not Republican Party, but forming a republic rather than a democracy, because democracy has always been what the tyrants want. They want, of course, all power to be left up to men, and what Montesquieu wrote about, he felt the Republican form of government based upon sort of a system similar to what they had in Great Britain. Now, Montesquieu was a Frenchman, but he looked to England, and he felt that this idea of a parliament, at least a government with a couple of houses there, the separation of powers, but really a government of laws where the power of government was to be restricted. So Montesquieu, is, in my estimation, the greatest contribution he had was this idea of a republic rather than the traditional concepts of democracy. Oh, we'll let everybody vote in whoever they want to, without realizing what Alexander Tyler had said so well at the time, and that was that democracies are temporary forms of government that last only until the people find they can vote themselves into the public treasury. They vote to get themselves more from someone else, and eventually that leads to the government going broke and being replaced by a dictatorship. And that is exactly what is happening in America today.
Yeah, exactly right.
And until people understand that we are a republic, and those ideas go back to Montesquieu, we can't really understand what is happening in America today. But I think what you bring out, you know, the Christian foundation of his belief system, of his worldview, transmitted to our forefathers, and then becoming part of our Constitution, which is the foundation of our freedom. America is no different than other countries. We're not a race. We're not, even today, necessarily one language. Of course, that is not by, I think that we would be far better off one language. But what unites us is a Christian worldview, and this concept of a government that was limited because the Holy Scriptures tell us you can't trust men with power. So would that be a fair statement?
Exactly, because that's what our founding fathers held to. They knew that the checks and balances had to be carefully placed, and the separation of power is very clear, carefully constructed to prevent any one branch, any one level of government from retaining too much power and being in a position where it could garner increasing amounts of power. We have seen that with the federal government as against the state and local governments in the past 100 years in our land.
Well, that was because of the 17th Amendment, which mm-hmm. never should have been passed.
Yes.
That was, of course, that the senators could be bought and sold by people of great wealth, rather than answerable to the states, where they could be statesmen, of whether they could represent the interests of the states, so that you could never centralize power in Washington, D.C. The 17th Amendment was passed by those who would convert us from a republic to a democracy, mm-hmm. and ultimately right. into despotism. And so people have to understand the history, and actually there's talk back in Washington, D.C., at least among a few of the senators, pointing out the 17th Amendment was a terrible mistake, a miscarriage of justice, undermining the very fabric of our society, and there are people back in Washington, D.C. calling for repeal of the 17th Amendment, but you won't hear about that, in your local newspapers or from Rush Limbaugh, because, of course, the people in charge don't want you to understand what's really happened.
That's right. They don't understand that we have lost the constitutional republic that was designed by our founding fathers. As I mentioned, the next significant influence on our founding fathers, actually some were his direct students. That is, they studied under Sir William Blackstone. Those that didn't study under Sir William Blackstone certainly had read his major work, Commentaries on the Laws of England. It was the most important law book throughout the Americas. As a matter of fact, we find that the Commentaries on the Laws of England actually sold more copies in the colonies, the 13 colonies, than they did back in England. Because they were looking to him, and if you read Commentaries on the Laws of England, you'll find that he is taking biblical principles, actually at times quoting Scripture and quoting precedent in Scripture as the example to give an understanding of English common law. English common law was based upon God's Word, based upon the Bible. Well, Blackstone gave them a clear understanding that there are three categories of law. The first is revealed law. He quoted, quoting Blackstone, "The doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures." Basically, the first category of law for Blackstone is the Bible. He called it revealed law. The second is the law of nature. Quoting Blackstone again, "When he created man," that is, God created man, "and endued him with free will to conduct himself in all parts of life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature, whereby that free will is in some degree regulated and restrained, and gave him also the faculty of reason to discover the purport of those laws." That's the law of nature. And again, if we look at just those two categories, revealed law and the law of nature, we find them quoted almost verbatim in the Declaration of Independence, that the one who created us and give us inalienable rights is the one who, from the laws of nature, a direct quote, and of nature's God, the laws of nature's God refer to the revealed law, that category that Blackstone so clearly taught. Now, William Blackstone spoke of a third category of law, that is municipal law, that is which is adopted by civil government. But notice this, it's very important to understand that Blackstone said municipal law must conform to the higher law of God, that is, revealed law and the law of nature. Quoting Blackstone again, "Upon these two foundations," that is, revealed law and the law of nature, "the law of nature and the law of revelation depend all human laws. That is to say, no human law should be suffered to contradict these." Again, what a radical statement in our day. If people understood that our founding fathers clearly believed what William Blackstone taught, that if any human being writes any law that's in the category of municipal law that disagrees with the revealed law, that is God's Word, the Bible, then it is no law at all. It should not be suffered to exist. It's null and void. Therefore, when judges decide that, as in Lawrence v. Texas, that the laws of the state of Texas that were in agreement with the revealed law of God declaring sodomy to be a crime, that law is no longer valid, it's the Supreme Court that's no longer valid. It's the Supreme Court that is contradicting the very basic foundational law undergirding our system of a constitutional republic. And Blackstone also taught this, which has been long forgotten in our land. It's the principle of judicial restraint, that judges do not make law. Rather, they discover and apply the law that's already made. That is, God's law revealed in Scripture and God's law revealed in nature. And our judges today, Supreme Court on down, have completely rejected this idea, and they are going around creating new rights that never existed in the Constitution, inventing new theories of interpreting that have no basis in the actual writings of our founding fathers or in the words of the Constitution itself. And, you know, you just read some of their decisions of Roe v. Wade, and you'll find it says, well, it was the penumbras, i.e., that is the shadows and the emanations from the Constitution. In other words, there's no basis at all for Roe v. Wade in our Constitution, and they actually admit that in their opinion there, Roe v. Wade. Well, in addition to Sir William Blackstone, John Locke was the next major influence upon our founding fathers. He was raised in a Puritan family, and basically we would say John Locke was Christian in his understanding, though he was not entirely orthodox, because he believed that human beings were born with a blank slate. They did not have any original sin in his conception of things, and you know, a few minor ways he was off. But what most people don't know is John Locke wrote a great deal about the Bible. For instance, he wrote a essay concerning human understanding of St. Paul's epistles by consulting St. Paul himself. Was one of his major works, and he was very interested in understanding what Scripture said. Well, Locke's major contributions to our framers' thought were threefold. First, that government is established by a covenant or a contract of the people, ultimately based upon, he's quoting Locke, that paction which God made with Noah after the deluge. After the flood, God made a covenant with Noah, and Locke said that's the basis, the pattern for which every civil government is formed. It's by a covenant, a contract that people enter into. And my goodness, Dr. Stan, if people understood that today, if they were to think of our relationship with our civil government as a contract, they were to think of other contracts they have in their life. You know, they have a contract when they purchase a car, or maybe they hire a contractor to make some repairs on their house or whatever. If the other party violates the contract that they have entered into, they have some recourse. You know, they could take them to court. They could sue them for violation of their contract. And that's why it's so important for Americans, and that's why we're dedicated at Institute on the Constitution to teaching Americans the contract. The contract with America is the Constitution, not something some senators and congressmen came up with. It is the Constitution. And we need to understand this contract, this covenant, in order to hold our elected officials accountable to the terms of this contract. So that was the first major contribution that Locke offered to our founding fathers. The second is that God has ordained the law of nature to which all human law must be subordinate. Again, repeating the thoughts of William Blackstone, that if the human law is written down, but it's in violation of the law of nature, the law that God has ordained, then it's no law at all. It's to be rejected.
Well, of course, actually, Blackstone lived to some extent after Locke, and I think that probably more Blackstone got his ideas from Locke rather than Locke getting his ideas from Blackstone.
Yeah.
But the ideas are eternal, and they're immortalized in the opening paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, where they talk about nature's God and nature's law. And, of course, nature was the laws of God. This is referring to the fact that everything is in perfect harmony, everything is in perfect balance, and we've forgotten that everything on this earth was made by the Lord in heaven, who we should worship. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment or two with our special guest this evening, and that, of course, is Pastor David Whitney. From the Institute of the Constitution, and I hope that many of you, after hearing this program, will seriously consider getting a kit for the Institute, which will contain about 12 half-hour lectures by Dr. John Eijmo, and down later on there are going to be lectures by Michael Perutka and certainly David Whitney, and then, of course, well, we'll tell you more about the Institute of the Constitution in a few minutes. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at the Radio Liberty, and of course, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney, and we were talking about the part that John Locke played in the formation of this great, marvelous country. And John Locke certainly was a nominal Christian. We can disagree on the various parts of Christianity, but I believe that he adhered to the precept that of Jesus Christ being our Lord and Savior, although he didn't believe in the Augustinian concept of original sin. But he was really one of the founding thinkers along this line. In fact, from Locke came many other philosophies that eventually were incorporated into the Constitution, American Constitution. What were some of those other things that Locke wrote about?
Locke spoke of, and this is, you know, almost directly quoting, in other words, Thomas Jefferson was directly quoting Locke's ideas when he said, the law of nature includes God-given natural rights. Locke didn't use the exact phrase unalienable rights, but he said there's chiefly life is one of the inalienable rights that God has given, and liberty and property. And our Declaration of Independence, the phrase, the pursuit of happiness, in our founders' writings definitely included property. Property was part of that ability to pursue the blessed life that our Creator God has provided for us. And so Locke gave us those clear understanding that at least there are three God-given rights that no human being should be deprived of.
In fact, it's really so interesting that my understanding is that in the original text of the Declaration, Jefferson had talked about life, liberty, and property, that Lockean phrase. And then, of course, when it was rewritten by the committee, they inserted the pursuit of happiness. But when you look at the Constitution, there are at least two places where they speak of life and liberty, and they always add property, because life and liberty without property rights are completely devoid of meaning. And that's why what's happening in America today with this right of eminent domain, so we can take your property away and give it to our favorite contractor so that he can build a great shopping center and make a great deal of profit on your the fact that you've lost your property rights, or they can just subdivide your property and sell it off to whoever they want to for a hotel, because we think a hotel would be better there than your store. This is totally corrupt and wrong. And we see now with the Environmental Protection Agency taking away the rights of private property through the environmental protection laws, and that old joke about the worst thing that you could find on your property would be an endangered moth or slug or salamander really has a very real meaning, because there have been people who have been threatened with jail for running over a kangaroo rat in the field, or having actually damaged in some way a swamp. We used to call them swamps, now they call them wetlands. Right. And it isn't amazing how they use words to deceive what this is really all about. A swamp is a swamp is a swamp. It breeds insects and disease and all sorts of things you don't want. But now we've sort of glorified them. And you know, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. And so we have to understand these concepts of the importance of private property.
That's
private
right.
Property is the very foundation of our freedom, and we can trace those ideas right back to the writings of John Locke, who, along with Blackstone and the others that we've talked about, were at Montesquieu, and I hope maybe you're even going to get to it's not Scotch theologian who wrote about these ideas of all men being created equal. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, and he's just been describing the fact that John Locke had written about this concept of life, liberty, and property, and these concepts are laid out within the Declaration of Independence and certainly within the Constitution. And in the Constitution, as we just said, every place they talk about life and liberty, they also talk about property. Isn't it tragic? We're losing our property rights here in the name of expediency. Why don't you pick up the story from there, David?
Yes, and in addition to John Locke, there were a number of other writers who influenced them, and these were thinkers who wrote on the issue of international law. That is, Grotius and Pufendorf and Vattel. These stressed that international law must also be based upon the revealed law, God's Word, the Bible, as well as the law of nature. So there was a circle of thinkers and writers at that time that were all in agreement, and they were all writing in the same vein of thought and contributing to our founders' understanding. many people would like to say that our founders, relied upon the Greek idea of democracy and so on, and some of the ancient writers and so forth. And yet, as Lutz and Heinemann did their study of the quotations of our founding fathers, they found that often when non-Christian sources were quoted, like Plato or later in time Voltaire, Rousseau, Hobbes, and Hume, these were quoted negatively. In other words, you find John Adams saying he was greatly disappointed when he read Plato's Republic, that it was a very disappointing structure because he knew it would fail. It was based upon a faulty view of humankind as sinless, and that human beings are not going to make terrible errors based upon a flaw in their human nature. And so he read Plato and he said, this is very disappointing because Plato just doesn't get it. He doesn't understand what the issues are in creating a civil government that actually is based upon the law of God.
And of course, if Plato really believed you could find some just man who would be totally selfless, you could put in as the world dictator.
That's right.
And that was his whole thesis. We can't trust the people with government. So in Plato's Republic, there was going to be a dictator, a man who is raised to be just totally selfless. There is no such man.
That's
because
right.
All men are created equal. They're created equal in sin, and they're created equal with that original sin that taints us, and they are corruptible, and that's why you could never give man unrestricted power.
That's right. And so if we were to take distill the thinking of all of those writers and talk about the concepts, the philosophy undergirding our founding fathers' view of civil government, we find that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God were the critical crux of the matter for them. What the meaning is of those two phrases is there exists a higher law than the law of any man or of any nation, and a law by which every human law must be judged. That is, God's law is the only ultimately true law, and any law created by human beings must be in coherence with God's law, or it's to be rejected, it's null and void. And my goodness, that is so far cry from what people think today. They think that anybody can get up and make any law they want, and sure, if they've got the power of the gun, they can enforce that law, and therefore it's law. Well, no. If a law is passed that takes away people's property rights, it's in violation of the law of nature and the law of nature's God. And it is not a law, it's lawlessness. It's as if, you might think that the mafia has taken over the government, And if the mafia took over the government and ran the government, in some ways, we see that really happening, sad to say, but if the mafia were running the government, people who really understood what was going on would say, wait a minute, the lawbreakers and the criminals are in control here. This is not law. This is lawlessness. Yes, they have the power in their hands, but it is not law. And that's what our founding fathers objected to in terms of how Great Britain was treating the colonies. That the Great Britain was treating the colonies as if the colonies had no God-given rights. The second aspect of that is that natural law is predicated upon the existence of objective truth. And as much as it's wild to even say this, that has to be emphasized today, because so many people believe the absolute idiocy that truth is relative. That what's true for you is not true for me, and vice versa, and it's like everybody's got their own version of truth. Well, if that's the case, then you have nothing but anarchy and chaos, because there is no reality, there is no truth. Everybody makes up the law for themselves, and they can enforce the law any way they choose, and you have no order in society, not to mention that it's irrational to say that there is no absolute truth, because that's making an absolute statement in itself. Then they spoke of the false view of natural law, which was Hobbes. Hobbes spoke of, and unfortunately many people, as they read the Declaration today, they interpret a Hobbesian view of the phrase, the laws of nature, which for Hobbes was kind of, we might call the law of the jungle,
Hold that thought, David. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And we're talking about the ideas that were the foundation upon of our country. They were the ideas that were quoted, or the people who were quoted the most by the founding fathers. And there was an analysis of this in a literary review. This was a scientific study, and they were just listing the various people who had an impact on the founding fathers and the, how their views worked. And David was saying that the views of Hobbes had an influence on the founding fathers. Tell us about Hobbes.
Hobbes had the view that basically we almost in our day, of course, it's much later, would call a Darwinian view that, you know, the fittest or the strongest survive, and it's dog eat dog and claw your way to the top. And he would have said that's the view of human nature that should be the basis of civil government. And our founding fathers clearly rejected that. Anytime they quoted Hobbes or his ideas, they said this is a false view. The laws of nature are not that which exists in nature. No, the laws of nature are what the Creator made, and not the distortion of what the Creator made that we would tend to find in the law of the jungle or that kind of thing. You know, when we speak of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we need to understand that our founding fathers had a clear definition of what those were, that if a person did not have the right to life, that is, they had no other rights. If you take away the right to life, all other rights are gone. The right to liberty is not just the freedom, as many people misconceive it today, the freedom to do whatever you please, you know, the liberty to decide for yourself what's right and wrong and decide which rules or which laws you're going to obey. No, it's not the freedom to do as you please. Liberty, in the understanding of our founding fathers, that is not just the freedom to do what you choose, but the freedom in making right choices, that is, in bringing your life into obedience and coherence with the law of God.
And
that's
John
what
Adams,
liberty was.
As John Adams had said, our form of government was made for a moral and religious people who would not work for any other. Mm. And so they recognized that you had to found your beliefs and determine your actions based upon God's law, or else, as you say, would have a moral anarchy.
That's right. The pursuit of happiness, as we've mentioned already, includes the idea of property, but it's more than just property. It equated the pursuit of virtue. That is, the only genuine basis for happiness, or perhaps a term that would more resonate in our day because happiness has been reduced in its understanding today, would be the pursuit of blessedness.
Hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our other stations back on board. Well, Dr. Stan here, and of course, David, Pastor David Whitney is our guest this evening, and he's just saying that the founding fathers rejected the beliefs of Hobbes, who really believed, more of a utilitarian view. It was this idea that certainly it was the survival of the fittest, the Darwinian idea. We probably should have a ruling aristocracy, and there are many people who always feel that the most capable should always rule. Well, of course, they may rule, but they should not have the right to rule. They will have to be selected, and they will have to adhere to God's law. So pick up the story from there, David.
Yes, the pursuit of happiness, again, is that concept that virtue is the only basis for true happiness, for lasting happiness, that if you violate God's law, you decide you're going to disobey the Ten Commandments, you're not going to find blessedness. You're not going to find happiness. You're going to find misery and suffering and grief in life. And so by the phrase the pursuit of happiness, they would include everything that involved a person following the commandments in God's Word to live a virtuous Christian life. And it's important to understand that because, again, people argued with homosexuals who are advocating that their rights as well, more than rights, I guess, their special privileges needed to be granted to them because the Declaration of Independence promised them that in the phrase the pursuit of happiness, and pursuing their perversion is their direction to pursue happiness. Therefore, the Declaration of Independence promises that to them. They have grossly misinterpreted what our founding fathers have said. Our founding fathers would say anybody that pursues that lifestyle of sodomy is pursuing destruction of themselves and of society, and not happiness at all. So that's the underlying principles, the ideas upon which our founding fathers built not only our Declaration, but our Constitution. And as the Declaration states, the equality that all men are created equal is based upon mankind being created in the image of God. In other words, this is a religious concept. People want to say, well, you got to separate religion from government. No, you can't. Not according to our founding fathers. The religious concepts, the Christian concepts, were key because your view of who a human being is. If a human being is just an animal, a la, you know, Marx or Freud or Darwin, if a human being is just an animal, our system of government cannot work. It's based upon this idea that human beings are created in the image of God, and therefore, because God is no respecter of persons, as Acts 10:34 says, then all human beings are equal before God, before the eyes of the law. In the Old Testament, when you study the legal system that God established for his people Israel, it was very clear that the Old Testament law prohibited partiality in judging. That is, the judges were not to make a distinction based upon a person's rank or upon a person's wealth or power or influence. Rather, they were to be impartial in judging because all men are created equal. That's a biblical concept. Then the next concept related to this is that human government, civil government, is biblically by consent of the governed. We have a number of examples through the Bible of this taking place. For example, in Judges chapter 8, as the people of Israel were seeking a leadership in a time they were struggling, the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." So there is the people of Israel choosing a leader for themselves. We find the same thing happening in chapter 9 of Judges, where Abimelech is chosen by the people of Israel. And we find that again in 2 Samuel 9, that the people of Israel are choosing, or 2 Samuel 16, rather, the people are choosing whether they're going to follow David or Absalom. Who is going to be king was up to the people to choose. And again, that occurs in 2 Kings chapter 14, as the people of God were choosing which king they were going to serve under. You see, government is by consent of the governed. That is, the people, we the people, who have entered into this contract with our government, we have freely entered into this contract, and this government is by consent. And therefore, they were completely justified in saying that their covenant with Britain, with King George III, had been broken, and that they were no longer consenting to this broken covenant that he had violated, and therefore, they had a God-given right as the people, we the people, to choose a form of government and to select a method for that to take place. And so because God is the ultimate king, God is the ultimate judge of the world, and he is the source of all authorities, they clearly recognized that they had a God-given right to form a government when the government that they were under had broken and violated God's law and violated their God-given rights. John Locke's theory of social contract entered into this in a very strong sense, that civil government is a contract. And this really is a radical idea in that day as well as in our day. Most people sit back and say, well, you know, I can't do anything about it. It's the government. You know, they're taking away our property rights. Well, it's the government. They have all the power and I have none. That's not our founding fathers' view. They understood that you, as a citizen, have a right, have a responsibility to be involved in what's taking place, because you don't just have to sit and take it. You don't have to sit back and say, well, I can't do anything about it. That's the government. They've got all the power. The social contract theory is very strongly stressed by our founding fathers.
And, of course, the whole idea of our form of government was it to be as much decentralized as possible. Certainly there were things that the Congress could do, but they were restricted in matters that they could vote on. Now that we've removed all of those, initially the Tenth Commandment limited what Congress could vote on. Our senators were not to be elected by the people. Why? Because if they were elected by the people, then of course people of great wealth would be able to manipulate the elections, give enough money, use enough of their influence to put the people in the Senate that they wanted, and those senators then would be answerable not to the people, but to the government agencies, to the financiers, to the bankers, anybody who was putting up the money for the senators. So we have to get back to this idea of the senators being elected by the states, and mm-hmm. they would be statesmen. They would represent the states and limiting the power of the federal government. How far we've gotten from that, in fact, the average citizen doesn't even understand the disastrous consequences of the 17th Amendment. So we have to get back to an understanding of our Constitution, which is what the Institute of the Constitution is really all about, isn't it?
That's right, and I ought to give our toll-free number, because if people would like to purchase a host kit, we've designed a system by which anyone, anywhere, with any group of people can communicate these truths about the Constitution. You don't have to be a historian, you don't have to be a lawyer, you don't have to have any expertise. All you need to do is provide a place and be willing to gather a group of people together to watch the half-hour videos by Dr. John Osmo, constitutional law professor, and following that, we have a discussion manual set up for you, a notebook for the students that gives a detailed outline of each of the lectures, and then you as the host, you have a series of questions that you interact with the class regarding what they have just seen and what they've just studied, and of course we give you the answers so that you look very intelligent, like you have studied this in great depth, but as you lead your class through these principles, you are enabling them to understand what our founders' philosophy was, what the religious worldview was, what the details. We walk through each of the articles of the Constitution and each of the amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, all these things to equip the average citizen to fulfill the responsibility that our founding fathers designed for each of us to fulfill. Well, if they want to order a host kit, Dr. Stan, they can call us at 1-886-730-9796. That's 1-886-730-9796.
You know what's up? Or they can go to your website at iotconline.com.
That's right. The last concept we need to stress is that our founding fathers believed very deeply in the sinfulness of human nature. They believed that man was sinful, self-interested, that he was corruptible, just as the Bible describes him. For example, James Madison, usually referred to as the father of the Constitution, said this: "If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it, that is the government, to control itself." That's from Federalist 51. Alexander Hamilton spoke similarly. He said, "Till the millennium comes, in spite of all our boasted light and purification, hypocrisy and treachery will continue to be the most successful commodities in the political market." And how true those words are, Dr. Stan, today, as you well know, with all the study and research that you have done. So they believe that government needs to curb man's sinful nature, but also the rulers, those who were the government officials, they have the same sinful nature as the rest of us. They need to be governed. They need to be have power, their power checked, and for that reason, God has limited governmental power. So at issue at the Constitutional Convention was how to give the government enough power to govern effectively, but limit that power so that government does not become tyrannical and corrupt given the fallen nature of man. As they wrestled and debated there at the Constitutional Convention, they came up with an answer. The answer is, do not let any individual or any agency of the civil government become too powerful. How to put that into effect? Well, their method was, we call it the Founding Fathers' five-fold formula. First is limited delegated powers. That is, you do not give any branch of government, federal, state, local, legislative, judicial, executive, you don't give any branch of government unlimited powers. And you only give them delegated powers. That is, you tell them what areas they have authority over, and you restrict where they have that. So limited delegated powers is first. Then second is the vertical division of powers. And that's what we speak of when we talk about the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. The third is the horizontal separation of powers. Now, many people don't think about this because, as you mentioned, the 17th Amendment has basically destroyed the horizontal separation of powers established by our founding fathers. That is, not only was there a separation of powers between legislative, judicial, and executive on the vertical plane, but on the horizontal plane, there was a wall of separation of the powers between the federal government, the state government, and the local government. And that has been very cleverly circumvented by the 17th Amendment, and now most people consider anybody that talks about states' rights to be, well, you know, one of those crazy Confederates that's still fighting the war between the states. Well, that war between the states, Dr. Stan, was all about this very issue. Would the federal government have jurisdiction over everything, or would the federal government been restricted to that area that our founding fathers gave to it? So,
but you know, David, a lot of the people in the North didn't want the federal government to have
right.
all the power either. In fact, it was just a very, very small group of people that wanted to centralize all this power in Washington, D.C., and whether Abraham Lincoln understood that or not, I don't know. But he led the country into a horrible fratricidal war.
Yeah.
They killed thousands of people who didn't want to be drafted. There were approximately 2,000 people killed in the draft riots in New England. And as a result of that, they had to issue the Emancipation Proclamation to give some reason for the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was not about slavery. It was about mercantilism. It was about the states' rights. But it was a couple of years into the war. I think it was 1862 before they issued the Emancipation Proclamation, because they had to give an excuse, sort of like our current war. Well, if it wasn't for weapons of mass destruction, it was because we wanted to bring democracy
right.
to Iraq. And they always have to come up with an excuse to get the people behind the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how tyrants rule their people. And I don't use that term lightly at all.
And so our founding fathers, their fivefold formula to prevent that from happening was limited delegated powers, vertical division of powers, horizontal separation of powers, checks and balances between each of those branches of government, as well as the horizontal separation, and then finally, reserved individual rights. And that's why the Bill of Rights contains the Ninth Amendment, talking about any rights that are not mentioned here are reserved to the people, or in the Tenth Amendment, reserved to the states. So there's a sense in which the Constitution is designed to be a set of walls and boundaries to rein in the federal government, to keep it within a very limited and constricted set of boundaries. Well, those boundaries, as you and I well know, have been destroyed, and we'll talk in the succeeding months about how that took place, but they have been destroyed as the federal government has broken all the boundaries that our founding fathers created to prevent it from becoming tyrannical.
Well, they've been able to do what they have done because they have prevented the American people from understanding our Constitution. They have intentionally not taught it in schools. They've intentionally undermined our understanding of this basic constitutional concept that you cannot trust government with power. And that the whole idea was to be the decentralization of power. Liberty and limited government were known to be synonymous, as tyranny and total government were known to be synonymous. But they have changed our textbooks. They've rewritten our encyclopedias. And if you doubt that, you really need to get the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which was written in 1958. That's Foundations, Their Power and Influence, written in 1958, and Radio Liberty has kept that in print for many years, because that book, more than any other, points out that there's been an organized, coordinated effort for many, many years, and going back almost 50 years, to change our perception of government. And what's happened is most of the people who understood our Constitution, 50 years ago have died off,
mm-hmm.
and the younger generation just doesn't understand. And that didn't happen by accident. It happened by intent.
And that's exactly why we at Institute of the Constitution are so committed to spreading this across the nation. As I mentioned to you before the show, last week I was out in California graduating two classes there, and the week before in Raleigh, North Carolina, graduating class there. We have a number of classes starting all over the country because we know that the people of America, if they really understood what our Constitution was designed, and they really understood how far we have gone away from that, and that we can return to that if the citizens wake up to the reality that they are to be the check, the final check and balance, so to speak, on the government, both federal and state and local, and that is there to hold their elected officials accountable to the terms of the contract, that is, to the Constitution. And unfortunately, most elected officials do not know the Constitution, that is, as it was interpreted by our founding fathers. They do not know the original intent, and therefore they're more than willing to go down the road towards tyranny, because it gives them power. It puts them in a position where their wealth and power are just going to increase. But if millions upon millions of Americans understand these principles, we can take our nation back from the tyrants who are currently in control of it.
And I would say not if, but when. Enough Americans understand
right.
what's going on. At that point, we will reach critical mass, and we can keep our freedom here as a way of life, rather than going into the new global government that is planned. And if you don't believe that it is planned, we actually have a government document that talks about the definition of terrorism, and the people who are considered terrorists, well, they're the people who are anti-globalists. In other words, who don't want to relinquish our sovereignty to the world government. We have that available if anybody wants to read it. Terrorist is somebody who doesn't want to go along with this plan to create a new world order, a new world religion. And they specifically use the term anti-globalist. Well, it's about time people understood that freedom is lost when good people do nothing, and that's why our plea to you is to seriously consider getting hold of Pastor David Whitney at the Institute of the Constitution. And again, that telephone number and website, David?
The 800 number is 1-886-730-9796. That's 1-886-730-9796, and the website is iotconline.com. You quoted earlier from John Adams, but let me quote what George Washington had to say: of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Our framers believed that freedom was impossible without Christian virtue, and that man did not possess that virtue naturally, and therefore Christianity had to be promoted in our land in order to produce the virtue that was necessary to maintain the freedom, the liberty that our land was designed to have. A writer of more recent times, 1959, said this, that the American Constitution is remarkable for its simplicity, but it can only suffice a people habitually correct in their actions and would be utterly inadequate to the wants of a different nation. Change the domestic habits of Americans, their religious devotion, and their respect for morality, and it will not be necessary to change a single letter in the Constitution in order to vary the whole form of their government. That's Francis Grund writing Aristocracy in America, and he's absolutely right. Our founding fathers knew that without godly Christian men in office and godly Christians going to the voting booths, the freedoms and the liberty that they knew were our God-given rights would be lost, because the words on the paper, as we've seen in the last couple of administrations, the words on paper don't mean a thing to those who do not hold to the founding principles that our founders held to. What we've just discussed here about the philosophy of government. If a person doesn't hold to those beliefs, the only way to prevent them from damaging the constitutional republic is to never let them get into any office of power in the United States, whether on a federal level, a state, or local level. Because anyone who does not hold to these principles is going to destroy the liberty and the freedom that our founding fathers so carefully constructed as they put together our constitutional republic.
David, that's so well said. I want to thank you so much for being with us here again at the on Radio Liberty, and of course we'll look forward to having you back again. I think it'll be probably for this listening audience, it'll be about a month. David will be back with us again as we go through a step by step the Institute of the Constitution. Good night.
Thank you.
God bless
you. Thank you so much, Dr.
Bye bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, you have to understand this is why they took over our Supreme Court, and as you heard me say many times, and if you want the documentation on this, we'll be glad to get it for you. Of course, it's in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, but why the Masons who worship a different God. Now, the average Mason doesn't even understand what this is all about, but we have 2 million Masons in America who've sworn allegiance to a different God. the great architect of the universe. Many of them think that they're in a Christian organization because there's a Christian Bible there. But believe me, if you were in a Muslim country, there would be a Quran. If you were in an Indian country, you would have their holy books there. Because Masonry is an international organization dedicated to the worship of a different God. And it was for that reason that they placed their people onto the Supreme Court, which they controlled from 1941 to 1971 in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. And it was during those years they created a wall of separation between church and state, took God and prayer, and eventually their friends took the Ten Commandments out of our schools, knowing full well that the only way to establish a dictatorship in America was to destroy the Christian foundation of America and raise a generation of people who had no idea that liberty and limited government were synonymous. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program with Pastor David Whitney, and we try to get him on at least once a month during this program to keep you abreast and to try to get you to understand that freedom is not free. It has to be purchased in every generation, and unless there are enough people who care about freedom, then it will be lost forever. So, I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. And you can do that by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Let me just close with a poem. It's known as The Unknown Soldier. It's a poem for Memorial Day. There's a graveyard near the White House where the unknown soldier lies. And the flowers there are sprinkled with the tears from mother's eyes. I stood there not so long ago with roses for the brave, and suddenly I heard a voice speak from out the grave. I am the unknown soldier, the spirit voice began, and I think I have the right to ask some questions, man to man. Are my buddies being taken care of? Was their victory so sweet? Is that big reward you offered selling pencils on the street? Did they really win the freedom they battled to achieve? Do you still respect the Croix de Guerre above the empty sleeve? Does a gold star in the window now mean anything at all? I wonder how my old girl feels when she hears a bugle call. And that baby who sang, "Hello, Central, give me no man's land." Can they replace her daddy with a military band? I wonder if the profiteers have satisfied their greed. I wonder if a soldier's mother ever is in need. I wonder if the kings who planted all are really satisfied. They played their game of checkers and 11 million died. I am the unknown soldier, and maybe I died in vain. But if I were alive and my country called, I'd do it all over again. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, there are people who have given their lives because they believed in America. And we can argue back and forth whether any of the wars of the last century were fought for the reasons that these men fought and died for. But if we appreciate what they did, if we believe in their sacrifice, we'd hope that many of you will give serious consideration to helping us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day by radio and internet, by shortwave, the internet, trying to reach people to make them understand we're losing our freedom because there are secret societies in America that control both political parties. Time is running out for our society. This year we will have in November the choice of two members of Skull and Bones, both of whom are controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front for a secret society that Cecil Rhodes created. And if you want the background of that, get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then Pray for America. Pray for the boys who lost their lives fighting for America, and that we do not dishonor them. Pledge yourself in this epic struggle for America. And so, until tomorrow at the same time, for those who are leaving us, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line Dr. Judith Reisman, who's written a number of books on Alfred Kinsey. Her latest, and certainly the book we carry, is entitled Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences. Now, you have to understand that the Muslim world looks upon America as a great Satan. Why? Because America is the greatest purveyor of pornography in the world today. There are over 200 pornographic film studios in California cranking out grotesque and horrible and demoralizing and degrading films that are being sent all over the world to corrupt their morality. They see our MTV, the suggestive forms of dancing, the scantily clad women, the Victoria Secret commercials. They say that this is contrary to the morals of their society, the Muslim world, and they look upon America as trying to infect theirs and destroy the morality of their society. And tragically, there's a great deal of truth in that. And this has happened because the good people in America do not understand what has really happened, why America has lost its moral compass, why America is no longer the beacon of morality and truth, why America is no longer truly a Christian nation. Although 50 years ago, everybody in the world knew America was a Christian nation, no politician would dare get up and make that statement today, for fear of being attacked by both the right and left media, and of course either destroyed or forced to retract that statement. And yet, 50 years ago, everybody knew America was a Christian nation. And along with that abandonment of the Christian theology, that which was the foundation of our society, and that didn't mean everybody had to be a Christian, that didn't mean that we were going to have a theocracy at all. It simply meant that there was a Christian worldview, and that was that, as it says in the scriptures, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And this idea of limiting the power of government, that we would have a tripart government, the Founding Fathers, as we expressed in the last hour, had a Christian worldview and realized you could never trust men with power. So you had to limit the power of government, unlike any other government in the world today, and certainly unlike the demonic world government, United Nations, that plans and will soon, if we do not intervene, establish a one-world tyranny. Why, America was founded as a nation where men could be free, and people from all over the world looked upon America with envy and realized, of course, that this is what they too wanted. How many people in the Islamic world, in fact, how many people in the rest of the world would really want what we have morally here today? Oh, they may envy our wealth, but wealth is a elusive thing, and wealth can soon be lost, and I fear it will be, as we transfer our industries and our jobs to other countries, as we systematically and intentionally destroy the value of the American dollar, the pensions, the annuities, the CDs, the bank deposits, the insurance policies, everything that so many Americans hold so dear and think give them security. And yet, of course, the truth of the matter is the only security we have is our eternal security, and that rests upon our belief in the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, with that as a background, let's go to Dr. Judith Reisman, who's really one of my favorite guests. And in her younger days, why, Judith was a part of the troop of Captain Kangaroo, and she was a writer for Captain Kangaroo, and put out a great deal of information, you know, a for that very, very popular television production. And then eventually she went on and got her PhD, and she began to study the demoralizing influence of Dr. Alfred Kinsey. And I'm going to let her pick up the story because I'm doing too much talking. Judith, please go ahead and give our listeners, many of them who don't know you, and we have all sorts of new listeners on this hour, give them your background, and then, of course, what you've discovered as you looked into the background of this sordid pervert, and that's all I can really say. Alfred Kinsey was a pervert who falsified scientific data, and yet he is glorified by the scientific community today, which I think is to the discredit of our universities and our scientific community. Judith, please pick up the story.
Well, thanks, Stan. I mean, you truly, as usual, have introduced this very tragic set of circumstances quite well. Dr. Kinsey himself turns out to be a clinically definable sexual psychopath at best, who in all probability was one of a group of pedophiles who sexually assaulted orally and manually
well, in every which way.
Yes. At least at minimum 317 infants and children, youngest being 2 months of age. Most of these children were boys. As a matter of fact, all but 14 were boys.
And isn't there a great deal to suggest that he was working with one of the Nazi commandants at the Nazi concentration camp?
Yes, Dr. Fritz von Baljuchek. In my book, Kinsey Crimes and Consequences, the last chapter of that book was really quite heuristic. I was trying to figure out where could Kinsey have gotten hundreds, if not thousands, of children to experiment on in this manner, sexually, in the 1930s and 1940s in the United States of America. And it's, you know, we had the possibility certainly of orphanages, and that's not ruled out. But one of the things at the time that I proposed was that it's possible that he got these children through someone in Germany, where they were at that time, World War II, conducting various kinds of experiments, and these would have been possible experiments that would have fit into their interests. But that was just a thought, a crazy, crazy thought that I had and that I followed up to some extent. And then the British production team under Timothy Tate, Yorkshire Television, asked if they could do a documentary on my work on Kinsey, and I said yes, of course. And one of the things they did was they followed up the German lead, and by golly, truth being stranger than fiction, it turned out that, yes, Kinsey was indeed corresponding with a Nazi pedophile, a bona fide pederast, actually, which is a homosexual pedophile. Well, actually, he was a both, so we could call him a pedophile, not a pederast. So he was corresponding with this man. He was encouraging his rapes of children and his sodomies.
But wasn't he working in the concentration camps?
Yes, the man himself was one of the early members of the Nazi Party and the Gestapo, of the Nazi Party. And he was commandant of a Polish village during World War II, in which he told the children, either it's up the chimney or it's me. And we found this was all discovered post World War II when this man, Dr. Fritz von Baljuchek, was arrested for the possible murder. It was a sex murder of a little girl, and they found his diaries in which he had exchanged letters with and collections of letters that he had exchanged with Dr. Kinsey. And Dr. Kinsey and he had been corresponding for some time. How long they had been corresponding, we don't know, and that's a whole story and a half, but certainly for some time. And Kinsey had actually sent him books about, quote, child sexuality, and encouraged him as a, quote, scientist, if you will, to continue his sexual assault of children, but Kinsey warned him that he had to be, quote, careful, lest he be discovered by the authorities.
And, of course, the amazing thing is that this was all covered in the German media and totally blacked out here in the United States, as was the TV documentary that was done by Yorkshire Television, a very, very professional job, and I've seen it, a wonderful video that could have been shown on PBS or ABC or NBC or NBC, but none of them would accept it because they do not want the American people to know the truth. And until people understand that our media is controlled and the really important issues are never discussed, and most of the issues that are discussed are simply to keep idle minds busy, to believe that you're seeing reality, whereas, of course, just as it was in that wonderful Jim Carrey film that talked about this young man who, lived in a make-believe world, that we really don't understand what's going on in the world today.
No, I didn't believe that we would ever show the film. The Brits were very shocked because, of course, it was shown throughout the United Kingdom and got a huge response from the British population. And they all just assumed that the Kinsey Institute was going to be shut down and that there would be arrests forthcoming. And, of course, so long as the public does not know in the United States, the Kinsey Institute does not get shut down. As a matter of fact, they get... They're up to $1.something million in grants for the next 3 years.
And that's, of course, American tax money going to finance their evaluation of perversion or
pornography. They're showing pornography to people to find out what they like best. what arouses them the most. So, and it's appropriate for the Kinsey Institute to do that since that's what Kinsey did all the time anyway. I mean, his staff and his people were involved in pornographic activity. And, in fact, the Institute, the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality in San Francisco, which was one of his satellite agencies, which provides expert witnesses and in courtroom testimony and legislative testimony all over the country, they actually sold child pornography made at their institute of a staff member and her little children to Hustler magazine to complement an article in which they were promoting incest and child sexual abuse. That's the foundation of human sexuality education in the United States, and these are the leaders of human sexuality education in the United States, the people who create the curricula that are in our classrooms, both parochial, public and private.
And even in our Christian schools, these ideas have snuck in. Now, really, Dr. Kinsey's goal was to change our laws of this country and our attitude towards sexual perversion. Kinsey himself was certainly a homosexual or bisexual. He was into sadism and masochism. He was certainly very supportive of pedophilia, whether he was a pedophile himself. He certainly worked with pedophiles. And this man, who is just totally corrupt and in every moral way, is the man who was instrumental in changing the laws of this once great Christian country to where we are today. Wouldn't you say that would be that he played an important part in the destruction of the moral fabric of our society?
Oh, absolutely. When we spoke earlier today, I mentioned there are so many frauds. There is so much false information disseminated out there that, you know, you think to yourself, well, why am I going to focus on this guy? I mean, you know, is he that much worse than anybody else? Is he that much more significant? And I think that my conclusion has been yes, that we would have to conclude that Dr. Alfred Kinsey was the most significant, you'd really have to say, moral philosopher of the 20th century, and probably the 21st.
How about an amoral philosopher?
Well, you know, morality, yeah, he was amoral. But that was his morality.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. And that's significant. I mean, he was, you know, we talk about Hume and other, quote, major philosophers who we say have affected society. I don't think that anyone has shaped us as dramatically as Kinsey has. Even Margaret Sanger couldn't get anywhere with Planned Parenthood until Kinsey came on board, and Freud was considered to be a European product and certainly did not have the power and the influence. Masters and Johnson came only because of Kinsey, became, you know, prominent, and they were Kinseyans, of course. So, yeah, it's critically important for people to understand that. On my website, I've got several articles that deal with the most recent sodomy decision, the Lawrence decision, which was 100% based upon the American Law Institute Model Penal Code, which of 1955, which was a Kinsey code. I mean, it was strictly Kinsey's fraud, human sexuality fraud, that formed the basis of the American Law Institute Model Penal Code. So, you know, we're alive and well and living under the pain and the suffering of this perverse man who believed that sexual promiscuity, was nirvana. This was the way to reach, you know, the heights of something rather. So, and who himself was impotent and unable to achieve any kind of satisfaction without torturing himself. So as we look around us at our youth and the decay and disintegration of our marriages and the spread of pornography everywhere we turn, we have to ask, you know, just as we would ask if people were being taught the new math and they couldn't add one and one and they were coming up with 12, we have to ask who taught us about sex, and that's who did.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the part that the Rockefeller Foundation played in funding Kinsey, their frantic efforts to cover this up when it was going to be brought out by a congressional committee back in the 1950s, and the fact that the Rockefeller Foundation knew that the research was fraudulent, and yet they continued to finance it. They were actually told by one of their investigators that Kinsey was a fraud. Isn't that true?
Yes, Warren Weaver, the most respected of their scientific advisors, couldn't understand why Rockefeller Foundation continued to support Kinsey, and in his letters to his higher ups, he raised that scores of times. He said, "There isn't anybody there who knows anything about statistics. They give out these statistics. They use a sample of one or two and call that a viable statistic." He said, and we do nothing about this. And the whole country is listening to this man as though he's producing viable statistical data, and there's no statistical validity here at all.
And, of course, the tragedy to me, Judith, is the fact that the universities across this country have supported this because of their silence. They won't dare speak out. They refuse to speak out. They glorify him. They have their own sex courses. And they use the foundation of research that they know was frankly invalid by Alfred Kinsey, who lied, who threw out statistics, who didn't agree with his preconceived concepts, a man who had a political agenda, and that was to change the moral fabric of our society. And he succeeded, but he could never have succeeded without the help of the Rockefeller Foundation, without the help of the media, and without the help of an academic community that is so corrupt they've lost all sight of what academics is really about, and that is a search for the truth and passing it on to the next generation, people who have a political philosophy, and that, of course, would be an atheistic philosophy aimed at changing America, indeed changing the world.
Yes, there's no question about that, unfortunately. Not that much different than what took place in Nazi Germany and in the Soviet Union, of course. And in China, in terms of the control of the intellectual structure by lackeys, really. I was stunned because when I first discovered the sexual abuse of these children in Kinsey's own work, I immediately went to my colleagues in the academic world and said, "My goodness, look at this, you know. We have to divest ourselves of this, of all this information, tell the public what's going on." And wasn't I shocked when nobody wanted to get on the boat with me?
Well, you've been on that boat for a long time, Judith, and you've had to row it alone, but at least I think you've had a tremendous impact, because I know the people on the other side hate you. The fact that you're bringing out the truth and showing their hypocrisy The hypocrisy of the scientific establishment in America is frightening. There's certainly some good people out there, but there's so many who won't speak out for righteousness. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Judith Reisman as soon as we get through the break. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest today is Dr. Judith Reisman, who's author of Kinsey, Crime and Consequences. And we're going to be, of course, we carry that book. If any of you out there are listening and would like to know more about it, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We also have a four-tape set on this very subject on Kinsey, and it includes some of my past interviews with Dr. Reisman, interviews with James Jones, who wrote the other classic biography on Alfred Kinsey, Colonel Ron Ray, and others, going into the background of what's happened. Well, now, Judith, as we look back, and how long have you been actually at this analysis and study of the Kinsey Institute and of Dr. Alfred Kinsey?
Well, since I met up with the academic pedophile movement, which was in 1976, I was in Wales and in the United Kingdom and at a British Psychological Association conference, and was presenting information on Playboy and child sexual abuse as a protocol, or child pornography as a protocol in Playboy. And after I presented my piece, a psychologist from Canada approached me and said, look, if you're really, really concerned about the spread of child sexual abuse, and of course we look back in 1976 and compare that today, and it's laughable, he said, then you really need to examine the work of Dr. Alfred Kinsey and Wardell Pomeroy, his co-author, who, by the way, turns out to be one of his many sex partners. And I said, why? And he said, I worked with Kinsey and Pomeroy. One is a pedophile, and the other is a homosexual. I said, which is which? He said, well, read and discover. And he just turned around and left. And I went back and started to look into the Kinsey issue and to look at Kinsey's data and read what he had said about children, and realized that indeed he was right, the Canadian psychologist, and it appeared that Kinsey was probably the pedophile at that time, and that this research was designed very specifically to legitimize adult sex with children.
In other words, to legitimize pedophilia, and that then sent you on over a quarter of a century of an odyssey, almost, well, 73 to
76.
Okay,
yes.
Well, it's almost 30 years, 27
yeah,
years you've been at this now.
Yeah. Well, we almost got a federal investigation in 1995. We had the support of some good, solid Republicans and some Democrats. And we were at a federal level just short of trying to get this thing investigated. And, you know, I keep talking about it since these people are being funded over and over again. And, of course, Pat Tomey, or I forgot if I can pronounce his name correctly, who was up against Senator Spector, just recently tried to get the funds going to the Kinsey Institute canceled. And I thought, this is the time. You know, these people are getting taxpayers' money.
Well, we can thank George Bush for backing Senator Spector, who is a liberal Republican, doesn't stand for anything Republicans stand for, but he was backed by our president against Tomey, who is an honest-to-goodness Christian. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Dr. Judith Reisman, and she's been telling us about the background of her study of Kinsey. Well, let's get a little bit into the fraudulent nature of his studies, because he really just cooked the books, didn't he, as they say in the vernacular of the accounting. But he cooked the books as far as his scientific studies. What's the background there?
Oh, yeah. Dr. Kinsey claimed at one point that he had interviewed 21,000 women and men. And you saw that in journals all over the country. I mean, this is the most well-reviewed report in American history. And he claimed that he interviewed 21,000 some, just regular folks. And then, of course, he changed that and said, well, actually, he hadn't, another place he said it was really 18,500, but that's still a huge number of people in those years and even today, so that the entire nation was being conned with the idea that there was a viable research study out there that this respectable scientist at Indiana University had launched, and that he was a very conservative fellow, right? He was portrayed in that manner, with a bow tie and smoking a pipe, and that this conservative gentleman at a conservative university had interviewed all these people. And the interview was brilliant, and he had a wonderful way of really eliciting the truth from everybody. I mean, this is a propaganda that was disseminated then, and it's still disseminated now. And that because he had this wonderful way of eliciting the truth from everybody, we now all knew what most Americans were doing. And what he said was that 95% of American men were committing sex offenses. He said that 10% of our males were homosexual at one point or another as adults, 10 to 37%. He said that 50% of spouses were cheating, all this to legalize adultery and sodomy and prostitution and so forth. And he said that 22% of our wives were having abortions, and that would legalize abortion. And that every, you know, really intelligent men were the ones who were using pornography, so we ought to legalize pornography, and that rape really was very rare, and it was basically just sort of impolite sex, and so we ought to lighten or eliminate our rape laws. And pretty much everything that he had argued for in his claim that sex has no public health consequences, forget AIDS, of course we didn't have AIDS in those years, so that we needed to end most of our sex laws and make the penalties, if there were penalties, very light, very trivial. And if we did that, Kinsey said, and admitted that this is all the stuff we were doing all along anyway, then we would have paradise lost, retrieved. We would lower our divorce rates, our venereal disease rates, our out-of-wedlock rates. It was going to be great. And, of course, now we have roughly 25 to 30 various venereal diseases, whereas we had 3 in those years, or 2, depending upon how you looked at it, that were large, you know, major problems. Illegitimacy is rampant, even despite condoms, despite the diaphragm, despite abortion. Abortion is legal. We even have a problem with our kids going to the local mattress store to have sex in public because pornography has been pumped throughout the entire nation, so much so, as you know, that the pornographic scenes in Iraq merely really reflect the sort of stuff that's been commonly going on between women and men. Are you there?
The end result could have been predicted. There's nothing new about it. They did this sort of thing in ancient Greece. You go to Corinth, and I've been there and seen the pillars of that great and wonderful city that was totally morally corrupt. And this has destroyed every country it's ever gotten into. It certainly was instrumental, part and parcel of the destruction of Rome. In fact, if you read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he talks about the sexual immorality and homosexuality that was instrumental in destroying that nation. And this is exactly what Kinsey was pushing in the United States, but also the Rockefeller Foundation, which was funding so much of the early research, was solidly behind this. And as you begin looking into the Rockefeller influence in America, whether it be in pornography, whether it would be certainly in in pushing the United Nations and immorality, and certainly funding Kinsey, you begin to catch a glimpse of the dark forces working behind the scenes of creating the tragedy we see today. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Judith Reisman, who will welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Judith Reisman, who in her book is, of course, Kinsey, Crime and Consequences. And we've been talking to her about the background of Kinsey and the fraudulent nature of his research. Has any of the scientific community ever come out and agreed that this really was scientific? Or is this one of those best-kept secrets within the scientific community?
Well, yeah, I mean, the scientific community continues to clamor that the research was scientific, and they have to. When I first, realized that we were looking at research conducted by, at best, a pedophile who was not active, and more likely a pedophile who was active, I just assumed that the scientific community would come on board immediately, and that we would make these major corrections in all of our school textbooks. And that those who've been getting PhDs in the field of human sexuality education and human sexuality therapy and all that, that these degrees would be rescinded because they were based upon fraud, and these people had been taught fraud and were now preaching fraud. And was surprised to find that I could not really get any support, nor certainly could I get any major publisher interested, really, in publishing the facts for American society. And then, if finally, over the years, I began to understand that there's just not a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a social worker, a sociologist, an anthropologist, there's just not anybody out there who is considered to be an expert and who addresses sex in anything they have written, who does not then quote Kinsey as viable and as their authority. And therefore, I would be putting all of these people in jeopardy. They would be exposed as individuals who never paid attention, probably never read the books that they quoted. Because the information was so clear, you had tables in which children were shown having so-called orgasms, 26 orgasms in 24 hours, a four-year-old child, or a two-month-old baby being similarly manipulated, and none of these brilliant experts who quote Kinsey and who talk about sexuality to the world, none of them had ever noticed that? Come on, that's ridiculous. So what I found was that I was completely stonewalled by the academic world at best, and became persona non throughout the academic world. And no, there's...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our special guest this evening, Dr. Judith Reisman. We're talking about her book, Kinsey, Crime and Consequences. And before we go on, Judith, let's get your telephone number or your website out there so people will know how they can reach you if they need to or they want to get in touch with your material.
Yeah, please. You can reach me through my website. It's Dr. for Dr. Judith, J-U-D-I-T-H. Reisman, R-E-I-S-M-A-N, .org. And you can go on there and get a message to me through the website. The email is up there. And or you can contact me through the email, which would be J-A Reisman, R-E-I-S-M-A-N, @surewest.net. That's SUREWEST.net. SureWest.net.
And now, of course, you mentioned that this video that had been put out by Yorkshire Television over in England, an excellent summary of the pedophilic background of Alfred Kinsey, his association with a German commandant who apparently was in charge then. Was it of a town rather than a camp, Judith?
Yes, it was a town in Poland, and the German commandant's name was Dr. Fritz von Baljuchek, and Dr. von Baljuchek was in charge of this Polish town, a large town, and told the children that it was either the chimney or him. They were either going to go into the chimney or they would have to yield to him. They all ended up in the chimney anyway. But he was a pedophile and engaged in this activity.
And he was eventually, of course, tried and convicted by German courts, and the news was totally suppressed here in America because of his intimate relationships with, and the documentation of his relationships with Alfred Kinsey, the great guru of American sex.
Oh, absolutely. And it was stunning because every German newspaper, in 1956, I think it was, had this on the front page for weeks, the trial of Dr. Fritz von Baljuchek. And by the way, that's on my website. I reprinted some of the newspaper articles on my website in German. There are so many more, I just haven't had a chance to get them put up. But every major German newspaper carried the story for weeks and weeks and weeks, since they said that this was the most horrific sex crime and sex criminal that had emerged in German history since World War II, certainly. And even in World War II, since this wasn't a standard kind of protocol during, you know, even amongst the worst of the German German officers at that time. So Kinsey encouraged him. He wrote to him. He told him to keep up the good work. He sent him books about child sexuality. I don't know what those books were. Von Baljuchek wrote back to Kinsey. There was an ongoing, intense, and energetic correspondence between these two men who really saw quite eye to eye with each other about what von Baljuchek was doing and what Kinsey chose to try to do himself.
All right, fine. And, of course, you mentioned on an earlier program that Dr. Laura, of radio and television fame, had sent a copy of the video from the British production company to PBS, suggesting they run this. But this has never been run by any of the major media in America, even though it's available to all of them. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely a fair statement. They have all refused to run it. The company was shocked because Yorkshire is a premier production house that does great work, and all of their stuff is picked up by American television and produced and done here, you know, arts and entertainment and 60 Minutes and all that sort of thing, and PBS. And so they were pretty stunned when it wasn't picked up here, since everybody in Great Britain was so supportive and was outraged. You know, the phone calls came pouring in, and the assumption, of course, was that the Kinsey Institute would be shut down and that everybody would be arrested.
Well, of course, what the American people must understand is your media is controlled, and anything as important as Kinsey, well, that information has to be suppressed from the American people. We can give you dozens of other incidents where all of the media has been complicit because there are CIA agents either planted within the media, at least according to a book written by General William Odom last year called Fixing Intelligence. He ought to know. He was in charge of NSA, the most secret of all our intelligence agencies, and since he couldn't come out and tell us that there were the CIA had people planted within the media, he just said, should the CIA be carrying out assassinations? Should the CIA have people planted within the journalists, planted within the media? And elsewhere he mentioned again the CIA having people planted in the media. Well, that's why we don't get the information, because there is a hand there that doesn't want the American people to understand the dark spiritual forces that are controlling so much of what the American people think. Well, right now we have Herman on the line. From calling from Carmel, and hi Herman, how are you doing?
Good evening. Thank you for having.
Hi
there. As Dr. Stan so often says, this lack of getting this onto PBS demonstrates the degree of control that certain forces have over our media. But I'd like to ask you, wasn't it Dr. Ruth that, I don't know, was Westheimer, who used to be the on television and answer people's questions about sexuality? Now, has she been, has she read your book or been sent your book?
Yeah, Dr. Ruth was, of course, her claim to fame came through her her role as an advisor in Playgirl, by the way, which is a pornography magazine for females or really for homosexual males, to tell you the truth. As a matter of fact, the Reader's Digest did a piece on my book some time ago, and they interviewed Dr. Ruth and told her, about the sexual violations, the rapes, sodomies on these little infants and children. And Dr. Ruth's comment to the Reader's Digest, quoted there, was, well, I don't care if about what he did. I don't care if he was right or wrong. I don't care, what he did at all. Without Dr. Kinsey, there would be no Dr. Ruth.
Oh, does that answer your question?
Well, I'm sure that would have made Dr. Mengele proud.
Right, I'm sure it would have, and certainly the Nazi commandant over in Germany as well. What you have to understand, I'm sure you do, is that there really is a brotherhood of darkness, of wicked and evil people. Now, I wouldn't say I know anything that much about Dr. Ruth, but I would say I would be very shocked at that sort of response from any sort of a moral individual. And what people have to do is understand that what is happening in our society, the moral breakdown, the degradation, the demoralization, the disillusionment, is not happening by accident, it is by intent. The final death throes of a once great moral nation, and short of a third great awakening in this country, with people turning back massively to God, why America, I feel, is doomed. Anything else, Herman?
Well, just a final question, I'll take it off the air. Do either of you feel that we are close to a turning point where maybe through calamities that are ahead that America will wake up and say, what the heck is going on?
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much, Herman. And let's ask Dr. Reisman, did you hear Herman's question?
Yes, I did. Do I? Well, we're called upon to be faithful. We're not called upon to be successful.
That term, we're to be faithful but not successful. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, we're supposed to, that's our job. And the rest of it is, I think, not in our hands. But, when we see what has taken place in Iraq and the pornographic flood that has engulfed our children, our little boys, our little girls, are losing any vestige of innocence and becoming so tawdry and so tarnished, so young. When we look at the way in which, serial rape murderers are being bred by our society, I think we are in a huge problem. And yes, it may be that things are getting so bad that, that we may be able to write it. I don't know. I know I've been working very hard on a new paradigm to define the meaning of pornography so that we can go into the courtrooms and challenge pornography now on a scientific basis, as opposed to what they called the Miller test, which was never a test and there's nothing scientific about it, but to begin to describe pornography as merely private space, intimate space conduct carried out in the public square at risk of species and self-destruction. That kind of definition can be proven in a courtroom. And to begin to try at least to wrest control out of the hands of media at this point through the court system, since it's so difficult to do it through legislative of channels anymore.
All right, let's go to Roger, who's calling in from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Hi, Roger.
Hi, folks. Thanks. And I'm kind of surprised you omitted this one disgusting little factoid. And you'll have to think that I was making this up if you didn't see it yourself, but Dr. Ruth Westheimer, of course, has been cycled through, I guess, numerous episodes of Sesame Street to teach our tender darlings their ABCs.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, she also recommended in a book of hers on young sex that little girls, that young girls practice eating ice cream cones, licking the ice cream cones, because that's what they should be doing with their boyfriends. And she also recommended that, you know, sadism and what she called sadomasochism could be perfectly appropriate for youngsters, you know, to engage in. So, you know, Dr. Ruth is hardly a moral individual.
All right, we will put her down as not a paragon of virtue. Anything else? Anything
she's
else there, Roger?
She's a little bit short of that. She's kind of short of that.
God bless. Thanks very much. And, you know, in response to Herman's question, and before I respond to it, let me just put out our number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, you know, I think that that idea that we're not called to be successful, we're called to be faithful or...
That was Mother Teresa. That wasn't me.
Well, anyway, I was thinking we could modify that for an alliteration. We're not required to be successful. We're required to be steadfast in our faith. And, of course, the battle is the Lord's. And we are, Herman asked if we're moving into difficult times. Yes, we are moving into difficult times. Financially, morally, we're moving into, I believe, very, very difficult times as far as the war is concerned. I think there's going to be increasing disillusionment. I think there are going to be terrible strikes. I think there's going to be a blowback from what we have done to the Arab world. They are going, of course, to retaliate against us in every way they can. And there are, and I will in my latest letter document the fact that there are terrorist cells all across here. Our government has known them about them for years and has left many of these in place. But I believe that tragically there are going to be some very difficult times for the people of Israel, for the people of the United States, and I can't say how the Lord is going to use that. All we can do is keep bringing the truth out, and if you're out there in the audience, your job is to help us expand our listening audience, to tell others, to listen to our programs, to tell them about what the future holds, and if they don't want to listen, that's their problem. But like the watchman that is described in Ezekiel 3 and in Ezekiel 33, we are to tell others what is happening. If we do not tell them, their blood is on our hands. If we do tell them, their blood is on their hands. And that's what keeps me going. And I suspect after all these years, it keeps you going as well, doesn't it, Judith?
Yes, I suppose so. I just don't see that we have a choice. We must do everything. Look, you know, it's gifts from the dead, and we are greatly privileged to live in this country. And you know, if we don't appreciate the type of governance that we have, and we permit it to be overcome by academicians or politicians or whoever else they are, then yeah, we there's no reason for us to believe that we will be any different than any other nation that has gone under.
All right, fine. Well, let's go. I think Herman is calling back again, so I'll put Herman on once more. Herman, did you have another question?
Well, just one comment. Both of my son and daughter went through the, I won't say which school, but a middle school and high school on the Monterey Peninsula, and one of the classmates, and they're now 23 years old, but she was a quote-unquote popular girl. We just recently found out she has, I don't know if she's either HIV positive or has AIDS, but she was popular and she did a lot of oral sex on the boys, and that's one reason why she was popular. And I hate to bring this up, but, you know, people may listen to you and say, well, who the heck cares about this story about Kennedy?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but when it affects, I mean, that could be any one of our children or our neighbors or friends, because they, you know, my kids used to go out with her and so
mm-hmm.
forth. You know, so it's close to home.
It sure does. Well, there's so many tragedies out there because our young people have believed what their seniors have told them, and that is that Kinsey was the expert. Kinsey was a pedophile. He was a homosexual. And those are the good things you can say about him. He was into sadomasochism. And until the American people understand that they've been lied to by the media, they've been lied to by their academics, they've been lied to by our political leaders, and certainly by the judges who have accepted Kinsey's philosophy to change the laws of our land, until the American people are willing to stand for righteousness, why we will continue on this downward spiral towards oblivion. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Herman.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, fine. We're going to, of course, drawing to the end of our program. If you do have another question, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Judith, can you give your website just once again?
Sure. It's Dr. Judith Reisman. So that's Dr. J-U-D-I-T-H. Reisman at, oh no, that's the, yeah, judithreisman.org. So it's drjudithreisman.org.
And of course, you have access to that video that was put out by Yorkshire Television.
Oh, yes.
I can get that through you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I recommend it for churches, for schools, for expert witness testimony, for lawyers who are trying to. We're dealing with major cases in courtrooms. You can always disabuse, you can always discredit your expert witnesses, because if they're on the other side and they're speaking about sex, we can always identify their connection to the Kinsey data.
And of course, I think that one of my most pleasant experiences was seeing Dr. Reisman on the Phil Donahue show, and she has a video. I don't think you don't circulate that, do you?
No.
All right, fine. But this is, of course, when she went on the Donahue show, and Donahue had promised her, you know, he would put up this this table from his book, The Sexual Behavior of the Human Male, that dealt with sexual torture of children. And then, of course, he got onto the program, and Donahue lied. He had no intention of putting up that. And why don't you explain what you did and how you got him, forced him to put up that information?
Well, they lied. And, of course, what Donahue attempted to do at the beginning was to just box me into a discussion of homosexuality. And I wanted to identify the pedophile nature of this research, not the homosexual issue at that particular time. Because I needed the audience to know who they were really dealing with. And so he refused to put up the slides of the charts and the graphs right out of Kinsey's own book, showing 24 hours around the clock, little babies being sexually tortured, screaming, crying, writhing, fainting, all this being done by a group of pedophiles. In Kinsey's own book. And so I decided, well, the mics were open at that time. And I figured, well, if I kept saying over and over and over again, all right, Phil, put up the charts, let the American public decide, let the American public decide, let them decide what this means. Let them see it. That at one point they would not be able to edit it out, and so they would have to put the charts up. And indeed, he did. He had to put up. So he put up table 34 and didn't want to. And the minute he put that up, I said, well, you look at that. Now tell me, how do you get 26 orgasms in 24 hours for a four-year-old? That's a round-the-clock experiment. You know, who is going to defend that? And, well, the audience was outraged. They were completely on side with me at that point. And so Donahue turned to Paul Tripp, who represented the Kinsey Institute at that point, a big expert in the field of human sexuality education, and he said, well, Mr. Tripp, you were with Kinsey, you were his photographer at the time, what are you saying? Tripp said, yes, well, Kinsey was using pedophiles, but he only used very responsible pedophiles because they had stopwatches to record their thing.
And, of course, this is really what it's all about. It was all right as long as they had stopwatches.
Mm-hmm, that made it scientific.
You really need to get the video of the Yorkshire television. Through Judith, there's so much more information you need to get. You need to help us, though, because this is part and parcel of the attack on the moral fabric and foundation of our society. And destroy the foundation of a society, you destroy that society. They're doing a great job of it, and they will succeed unless there are enough Americans who are willing to become informed and join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation, a ready nation founded on godly principles, founded on the scriptures, the holy scriptures, can long exist. Well, Judith, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
On my side, too, and thank you so much, Dr. Stan. You do a great job, and I always listen to your tapes.
Good night.
I listen to you, and I want everybody else out there to continue to support Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right, fine. That's Dr. Judith Reisman, and I hope you enjoyed our program. We carry a book. It's entitled The Kinsey Crime and Crimes and Consequences. We also carry a four-tape set with interviews with Dr. Judith Reisman, Colonel Ron Ray, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and James Jones, who wrote the classic book, the other classic biography, I should say, on Dr. Alfred Kinsey. Dr. Judith Reisman's book is a biography that is critical of Kinsey. Dr. Jones's book is very praiseworthy of Dr. Kinsey, but it's important you understand what he says, because he didn't see anything wrong with the homosexuality, giving his wife to other men, and of course his multiple homosexual escapades, his sadism and masochism. That was all perfectly normal. It was only when I broached the problem of pedophilia and his support of pedophilia that Dr. Jones admitted, well, there are certain things that aren't acceptable, but then who's to determine what's acceptable in the Bible? Are we to be our own gods to say what's right and wrong, or should we look to the God that created the heaven and earth for his moral standards? And that is our plea when we try to make the decisions on our own. Why? Because we are human and certainly fallible, so often we'll make the wrong decisions. That's why the Holy Scriptures lays out patterns of behavior, and we're certainly far better to follow those than our own dictates. So, well, we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The Dr. Reisman's book is available. Our four-tape set on Kinsey is available. And remember, Dr. Reisman's book is A Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences, and our four-tape set is simply entitled Kinsey. We have so many other four-tape sets. If you haven't heard the New Order of the Barbarians four-tape set or read the transcript that goes with that, it is the testimony of Dr. Richard Day, or at least it's a discussion of a talk given by Dr. Richard Day, who was the medical executive and medical director of Planned Parenthood. It was a talk given in 69 where he told how the order, and he never told who was in the order, but the order which really runs America, and that was his term for it, how they were planning on promoting promiscuity and abortion and sexuality without reproduction, reproduction without sex, creating new diseases to kill off the population because there were just too many people in the world, withholding treatments for cancer because there were just too many people in the world. One of the most incredible four tape sets, it's called The New Order of the Barbarians. And so we hope that many of you will help us to get information out across America. And if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our number 1-800-544-8927, please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day. We're also 4 hours a day on shortwave, and that's at 5.745 megahertz. You can get that from our website, or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send a catalog. And please pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Remember the boys who fought and died for America in the past. Are we to ignore their sacrifice to allow us to have freedom? Because freedom has to be protected in every generation. and freedom is under attack today. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.